This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Hey folks, welcome to the show. In our most recent podcasts focusing on nutrition, we have been talking through different types of diets and nutrition strategies to learn all about the pros, cons, and the best ways to implement them. If you missed our first few in this series, go back and check out episode 59 about plant-based nutrition and episode 64 about high-fat, low-carb nutrition for athletes. Today, we continue the nutrition approach series talking about carbohydrate periodization. Our key guide for this talk is our resident nutritional expert, Dr. Krista Austin. Krista is an exercise physiologist and nutritionist who consulted with the U.S. Olympic Committee and the English Institute of Sport. She has a PhD in exercise physiology and sports nutrition, a master's degree in exercise physiology, and is a certified strength and conditioning specialist. Krista, thanks for coming back on to talk about carbs.
Hey, good to be back with you, Andrew. And I'm always down for talking about carbs. I have to make sure I carbohydrate periodize on a regular basis or else I can get into trouble.
Yes.
So.
Yep. I'm right there with you. Also joining us for this talk is pro triathlete and coach Elizabeth James. Elizabeth came to the sport from a soccer background and quickly rose through the ranks using TriDot, from a beginner to top age grouper to a professional triathlete. She's a Kona and Boston Marathon qualifier who has coached triathletes with TriDot since 2014. Elizabeth, how are you today?
I am doing really well, thank you. How about yourself?
I am great. I have had my carbohydrate-rich breakfast and am ready to talk about my favorite of the macronutrients with you and Dr. Austin today. So I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation, and then we're going to wrap things up with our cool down, which we have a great question from an athlete for Dr. Austin today. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
If you could take one indulgent, non-nutritious food and kind of just wave a magic wand and poof, now it is super healthy and super nutritious, what food would you choose to make healthy and nutritious? Elizabeth, I will start with you today.
Well, it's probably going to be no surprise what my answer is. Our listeners know that I am quite the ice cream lover, so absolutely ice cream would be the thing that I would say. And I'm talking like the chocolate fudge brownie, add in some extra cookie dough type of ice cream there. So if we can make that super nutritious, that would be fantastic.
So not just your average, you know, scoop of chocolate ice cream. Like you're talking like decked out, toppinged out, you know, go down the Cold Stone or the marble slab and have them just mix in as many different types of sugar as you can get. If you could take that ice cream and pack it full of nutrients, that would be your pick.
Yes, like our chocolate peanut butter mix in masterpiece. That would be my go-to.
Yeah, can you imagine that fulfilling like the same nutrients that you would get from like one of your salads for lunch? Like that would just be your dream scenario, right?
Man, yeah. That would be fantastic.
Dr. Austin, what is an indulgent food item, something that you have maybe from time to time as a treat that you really like, that is not super healthy, that if you could make it healthy, you would just have it all the freaking time?
Well, that would have to be some really good churros. Ooh. With vanilla ice cream and chocolate topping. Every once in a while, I go and I get that, Andrew, and I just love it. Like, it's got to be my birthday or something, but I have a real thing for desserts, a lot like Elizabeth. So I would say that probably would be the number one item on my list.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with that. And one of these years, Dr. Austin, you'll have to travel to Texas for the Texas State Fair because they have all sorts of vendors with different variations of churros and different toppings. And I imagine you can get some of that in San Diego as well. But that's definitely a staple of the Texas State Fair is the churros that are offered there every year. So that's a great pick, and not one that I necessarily would have thought of. So that's kind of your go-to birthday treat dessert then?
Yeah, at this point, that's what it is. You know, it hasn't always been that. I've had a lot of phenomenal desserts over my lifetime. And I would just say that right now, that's the one that is a go-to. And I use birthdays as the reason to go and enjoy it, because otherwise I'd be there every weekend, you know, like enjoying that dessert. So
yeah,
I gotta put it in check.
Yeah, I've got to make it a special occasion thing. For me, this, I've got to just go with the cookie. And it's fun that we're all picking different desserts today. You know, just a good chocolate chip cookie, a good peanut butter cookie, sugar cookies. I'm not picky. If it's sweet, it's got chocolate in it, I'm all for it. They're here in Texas. I know these are kind of spread out throughout the country. There's a cookie chain called Crumble Cookies, where every week they'll release 6 new cookies. And so when you go, they're absolutely massive, and they just have a variety of toppings. And so me and my wife, like, we'll check every Sunday. They'll update the menu for our local Crumble location, and it'll say, here's the 6 cookies we have this week. And they're always like a peanut butter cookie or a chocolate cookie or a sugar cookie, but then they're topped with like different things, you know, Butterfingers and Oreos and, you know, Nutella, and they just have so many different variations of cookies. And so we'll pull up the menu and see, okay, what 6 cookies does Crumble have this week? And we'll wait for a week where there's just one on the menu that we just can't say no to. And that's when we'll drive out and get a Crumble cookie and make it a kind of a weekend treat. We're going to throw this out on the I Am Tried Out Facebook group. If you're not a part of that group, make sure you go and join it on Facebook. We have thousands of athletes there that just talk, swim, bike, and run all week long. And you'll see this question today. You'll see the question, if you could take an indulgent food and make it super healthy with a wave of a magic wand, what would you choose?
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Our main set today is brought to you by our good friends at UCAN. Here at TriDot, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. In the crowded field of nutrition companies, what separates UCAN from the pack is the science behind their superstarch, the key ingredient in UCAN products. While most energy powders are filled with sugar or stimulants that cause a spike or crash, UCAN energy powders, powered by superstarch, deliver a steady release of complex carbs to give you stable blood sugar and provide long-lasting energy. UCAN also offers tasty and refreshing hydration mixes and energy bars for when you are on the go. When I was new to UCAN, my first purchase was their perfectly named Tri-Starter Pack. It's the best way to discover what superstarch-powered UCAN products are best for you. So head to their website, generationucan.com, and use the code TRIDOT to save 15% on your entire order. Everyone's dietary preferences are a little bit different, but for me, it seems like everything I love in this world is a carb. Some folks like me probably love carbs a little bit too much, while others avoid them in favor of other macronutrients. So in the end, what role do carbs play in our fueling? And how can carbohydrate periodization offer a balanced, well-thought-out approach to taking in carbohydrate? Krista, with all the many nutrition plans marketed to athletes, you know, some of which we've already talked about on the podcast, it can be hard to know which way to go as an athlete. Is there an approach to choosing your nutrition plan that allows you to kind of have the best of all of these approaches using carbohydrates?
Yeah, so what we've learned to do over the years, Andrew, with athletes is something called carbohydrate periodization. And essentially, it allows you to go meal to meal, or maybe even just day to day, and manipulate the amount and type of carbohydrate that you're taking in. And the goal is to have a mixture of low, moderate, and high carbohydrates available based on the type of training you're doing, and really the metabolic environment that you're trying to create. Because for many people, that varies throughout the day, and it's dependent also on their health, not just on their training. Oftentimes, we utilize what's called nutrient timing or principles of nutrient timing to help provide the strategy to athletes. Even with the other macronutrients, we will combine them with carbohydrates to enhance the concept of carbohydrate periodization and really create the metabolic training adaptations that we're looking for. especially if we want athletes to have a greater reliance on fat metabolism.
So this has always been something that's really interesting to me. And I know that last year when our staff attended the Endurance Exchange Conference, I went to one of the breakout sessions. And within that particular session, one of the speakers had worked with a professional cycling team on their nutrition. And he was discussing, you know, how he had worked with each rider on their nutritional intake and just kind of exactly what you were talking about, the manipulation of carbohydrates, either session to session or day to day based on their training. And then he also discussed how he then applied that to working with the cycling team as they were riding in each stage of the Tour de France. And so that was just fascinating to me, the level of detail that went in there and kind of the manipulation of the carbohydrates based on what each rider was doing. You know, but since most of us don't quite have that same level of service with, you know, all of our meals being cooked and portioned for us and just available for our consumption based on our energy needs, you know, how do we go about, like, you know, creating or thinking about manipulating our carbohydrate intake?
So the first thing I recommend to athletes is to understand everything based on the actual training sessions or the competition maybe that you're going to need to fuel. Once you understand what you're fueling, then you can create the actual strategy. And oftentimes this means not only understanding energy expenditure, but also understanding how you're going to do it. At what level of intensity? Should you be burning fat and carbohydrates? Should you be relying more so on carbohydrates predominantly to get the session done? Or should we be relying on fat predominantly to get the session accomplished? Those are factors that will actually help us create that performance approach to nutrition, but also implement the concept of periodization. And so it takes oftentimes a good understanding of what it is you're going to do in that training sessions and how you best need to fuel it. Then on top of that, you need to understand your overall goals for body weight and composition. And the reason this is so important is that oftentimes we use periodization overall throughout the year to manipulate weight, to manipulate the composition, the muscle mass and fat mass that an athlete carries. And the question is, what do we need to do at a specific time of year? So for example, in the preseason, that's often when we're going to actually work on body weight, okay? And really start to identify where that weight is, or if we know where that weight is, we're going to say, hey, this is where we need to get. And then throughout the rest of the year, we keep working on composition. So sometimes it's about giving the body a gradual twist with regards to carbohydrate periodization so that we can achieve the weight and composition goals. I know for myself, and you guys have probably seen this too, Elizabeth and Andrew, that if you change just even the type of carbohydrates you're consuming, your body composition starts to change. Uh-huh. And when they're healthier carbohydrates or the more low glycemic, you end up with less body fat, as long as, you know, we're not too much of an energy deficit or not too much over our energy intake that we should be consuming. So it's a huge part of looking at periodization globally and saying, when do I need what? When do I need to be where? And that's where a plan is actually really crucial to help us ensure not only the health of an athlete, but to get to our desired weight, our desired body composition, our desired performance goals, right, at the right times of year, and not try to be there all the time.
The first example I think of, Dr. Austin, when you're talking about just how, depending on what we're eating more of, you know, our body composition changes. I mean, everybody, you know, goes into the holidays just knowing, okay, I'm going to eat a little bit more sweets than I probably normally do. I'm heading in the wintertime, so I'm probably going to eat, you know, some more, you know, warm soups and warm breads and you know, warm savory meals to cope with the outdoor cold. And so everybody kind of just knows, you know, when you do that and you give into that, you know, your body composition in the wintertime, you're going to put on a little bit of that winter weight. And then, you know, the summer comes around and a lot of people tend to drop a little bit in the summer because now instead of eating all those, you know, Christmas and Thanksgiving desserts and extra foods, they're sliding kind of more into the summer salad mode and the summer fruit mode and getting on board with that. So is that kind of a normal ebb and flow for most athletes, or is there a little bit more to it for athletes?
I would say there's a little more to it for most athletes. It all depends on what stage of competition or your competition level that you're actually at. And also, you know, what were you just kind of given genetically? And for some people, genetically, they automatically have the metabolism. They automatically have the insulin regulation and carbohydrate utilization rates, fat utilization rates that make everything just kind of tick along. And they can be a lot looser, I would say. Then there's others of us that we have to clamp down a lot earlier in the season. We've got to be far more conscientious. And we need to be cognizant of how we respond as an individual. How cognizant do you have to be? And you also see that with age. You know, I'm a little bit older than the two of you, and I would tell you that when I was younger, I got by with a lot. I mean, I got by with a whole lot. But as you get, older, guess what happens? You don't get by with quite as much. I mean, that's for a variety of reasons. And so I think we have to take each athlete as an individual and be cognizant of not only their genetics, but also the age and stage of development that they're at and design the plan based on that.
Well, we're going to have to circle back around and get it on the calendar to do a kind of race weight, you know, seasonal weight manipulation episode with you to kind of talk through some of those seasonal ebbs and flows that athletes go through and why we do them and how we do them and you know, how to determine what your ideal race weight should be, you know, but for today, you know, you said something just a minute ago in just talking about the different types of sessions there are. You know, you can go into a 1 hour long run, and not every, you know, 1 hour run is the same. You know, sometimes you're going to have some more harder intervals, and some days you're running all at zone two. And so what we're doing in a particular session can have an impact on how we kind of fuel with the carbohydrates and how we periodize that food intake. So let's kind of talk through some of those different types of sessions and kind of learn as athletes, okay, what should I be eating before I go into a hard run? What should I be eating, you know, before, during, after a zone two swim or zone two bike? So let's kind of start with the days we have a low interval training session. Can you give an example of how we might periodize the carbohydrates to help optimize performance and health on a low intensity day?
So on a low intensity day, a lot of the goal is to actually do something such as recovery or to just build aerobic metabolism. Okay, so what you want to look at there in terms of carbohydrate intake is what type are you taking in that can maximize what I call fiber content. Okay, these are your low glycemic carbs. And we need to maximize our use of protein and fat to further help slow down the effects of those carbohydrates. And oftentimes before those low intensity sets, you know, we need to get calories in, but the question is, how are you going to get those calories in? And oftentimes for athletes who are looking to have better metabolic control, we'll use protein and fat. It might be something that comes in eggs, right? And we just put vegetables into the eggs to have a nice omelet, to give them a good breakfast with the calories they need, but to also then optimize the metabolic response. It also helps them with things like hunger and satiety. I mean, most athletes tell me they're hungry on a very regular basis. With all the training that they do, sometimes the hunger signals can override what they really need to be taking in. And so we will use macronutrients intentionally to help control the hunger and satiety aspects and help them stay in line with what it is they're trying to achieve. We want to control on those days their insulin levels far better than we would on maybe a moderate to high intensity day, just because they're not going to burn the calories. They're not going to be depleting carbohydrate stores. And so we need to think about it from that perspective. And the question is, how low glycemic do we need to go? And I think that's something that everyone has to ask themselves. You know, people who are on a high fat diet typically are on, you know, the lowest glycemic you can possibly get. And so in their, you know, instance, we might actually on even a low intensity day intentionally provide them with some carbohydrates to help them get through it. So they're kind of the flip-flop. So like if we're going to send them out for, let's say, a 3 to 4 hour ride, maybe they're a long course athlete, and expect them to keep going, even if it is at a really low intensity, we may give them some low glycemic carbohydrates to actually help them get through it. So at any point in time when you're looking at intensity of exercise and how to fuel your body, you got to take into account the overall nutrition plan that an athlete's on. We can't just say, hey, this is the one thing that's right for everybody.
I love those examples that you gave. Just as you were talking, I was thinking, oh yeah, I mean, there's days where I have low intensity training, but I am just super hungry.
Starving.
Yeah. Like, it's when is my next snack? And oh my goodness, I feel like I could raid the fridge even though I've just done, you know, a zone 2 run and an hour swim. And my appetite is through the roof. And so, yeah, being able to really think about how we can manipulate some of those macronutrients to support us is amazing. And then, I mean, on the flip side there, the other example you gave of, yeah, it might be low intensity, but how long is the duration? And so kind of looking at that too, of it might be low intensity, but if you're out there for a couple hours, you still may need to support that training session with some lower glycemic carbs too. I think this is just a great way for us to kind of go through and really provide athletes with some examples. I know we've just talked through low intensity, so let's just kind of move up the scale. And how about on a day when there's a moderate intensity training session? You know, how might we periodize carbohydrates there to optimize performance?
So in that instance, typically what I'll have athletes do is to utilize a low glycemic carbohydrate prior to the session, and typically it's combined with both protein and fat. So in that instance, we might take, let's say it's, you know, breakfast in essence, prior to your first session of the day, some oatmeal with some almond milk that's fortified with protein, some almond butter, put some banana on top, and you've got a very low glycemic meal at that point. And the question is, you know, how well do you need to actually fuel the session? So we make sure that the calories in that instance are sufficient to supply the session. And then of course, immediately post, we would look at something more so like a moderate glycemic carbohydrate, such as a sweet potato, and to help refuel and just, you know, give you some more complex carbohydrate, and then go back for the rest of the day if we're not going to be doing other training, and move back towards the low glycemic carbohydrates that you incorporate into each meal or snack. Now, if you're going to continue training, then you might want to say, hey, I've got 2 moderate training sessions. Let me replicate what I just did with the first and continue that through the other session. It might even be a third session. So you need to be cognizant across the board. If it's going to be a moderate day on the whole, you know, what are you doing throughout the entire day, and not just at the one training session. For the high fat athlete, what we would do is probably have them consume a greater amount of carbohydrate pre, during, and immediately after training, and focus on increasing their calorie intake post training to help address their calorie deficit, but also make sure it's appropriate for putting them back into ketosis, which is often where they want to be.
In that example, you mentioned, you know, kind of back to back, you know, days that have 2 or more training sessions. And it made me think of too, you know, some of the examples that we've already talked about, we're talking about breakfast, you know, what somebody might have for breakfast, you know, before a training session. And it's making me hungry for breakfast right now, just thinking about vegetables and an omelet. I actually had an omelet with fig in it for the first time about a month ago, and I haven't stopped talking about it to my wife since then.
Oh, so good.
Right?
Yes. Delicious.
Yeah, I think it was fig and bacon. I don't remember the fig was the standout. So I don't even remember what the other toppings were. But anyway, you know, Dr. Austin, for athletes that maybe they have, you know, one moderate workout or one, you know, low intensity workout, whatever the intensity is, if they're doing that session maybe later in the day, you know, after work or after some other obligations, you know, would they just approach lunch or would they approach, you know, a snack later in the day, you know, kind of in the same terms you're talking about approaching breakfast, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you have to ask yourself is, you know, does lunch cover down on what I'm getting ready to do? I mean, they can eat a low glycemic lunch 3 hours before that training session. And at the end of the day, it can fuel the training session they're going into. It's just, you know, really up to how long will that session last. So continuously asking yourself, where am I throughout the day? And that's what's important. If you train later in the day, the question is, do you just need to give your body calories, period, to get through that training session and learn to differentiate between providing it calories and providing it a certain type of fuel? What I find about a lot of athletes that go into training later on in the day is that they just haven't eaten enough going into the training session. And so they rely on the wrong type of carbohydrates to fuel the session. And so we need to be thinking about our timeline. What do we need to be eating? When do we need to be eating it? So that we don't get to that afternoon session and all of a sudden have a donut right before it and maybe impede the, you know, what it is we were trying to do. So I think it's just about planning, Andrew, and making sure we're cognizant of how long in between our last meal and that training session we're actually gonna be, because that meal may be able to suffice for whatever it is we're trying to accomplish in training. So it's just about always thinking about the time point before that training session.
Yeah, see, a donut would be a prime example of something that we wish was more nutrient rich than it actually is. Kind of how we were talking about the moral question. If I could have a donut an hour before a workout and have that fuel me with proper nutrients, that would be amazing. For me, I think in that instance, you know, if I need just a little bit of energy, you know, before a late afternoon workout, you know, for me, it's a Yucan almond nut butter bar. And I'll have one of those about 45 minutes out from an afternoon workout. If I know, okay, it's been 3 or 4 hours since I had lunch, or maybe I had a small lunch. And that usually, does it for me. What are a couple other kind of quick examples of something we could use in that scenario, trying to get some energy in before a late in the day workout?
Yeah. So I always go back to my low residue foods and try to figure out how to make them, even though they don't have a whole lot of fiber. How do I make them low glycemic or moderate glycemic? And what I usually use as like a default is either a peanut butter or almond butter and honey sandwich, or putting it on a tortilla and making sure that that tortilla or that bread doesn't have a lot of fiber in it, making sure that it's very low fiber. And it gives you a nice blend, because honey is still low glycemic, and so is, you know, if you blend it with the peanut butter, it keeps bringing the glycemic index down. And then even if you put it on like a plain white tortilla, you still got probably a moderate glycemic snack right there. So that's one of my go-tos. You can also fold up the tortilla and put it into a backpack or something and carry it with you pretty easily.
Nope, that sounds delicious. I love honey. I love nut butters. And we always have tortillas in our refrigerator. So I'm going to remember that one for sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, and let's be honest, Andrew's not getting up for workouts, so he's thinking more along the lines of, what can I eat before my workout? Because I'm not getting up in the morning.
That's why I'm asking these follow-up questions, Elizabeth. It's for me, but then it's also for athletes who are like me, and mm-hmm. they've got that session in the afternoon, right? That's something that a lot of people face. We're not all morning birds. But anyway, so we've talked about kind of low-intensity sessions, moderate sessions. So let's kind of round it out with those high intensity training sessions. Is there anything different we should do in our periodization of carbohydrates, to optimize our performance in a high intensity training session?
Yeah. So for any high intensity training session, you want to make it count. Okay. And so that's when I do ask athletes if it's going to be sufficient enough, a prolonged enough session, to turn around and rely on some moderate to high glycemic carbohydrates to optimize what they're able to do during that session. So for example, they might turn around and have some cream of rice rather than oatmeal if it's prior to, you know, to a, you know, it's a morning session and you're having breakfast beforehand. And then to fuel with that type of carbohydrate during and immediately after training. And, you know, we really, you know, most people say, oh, there's all those high glycemic carbs, Krista. But I say, yeah, but how frequently do we do this in the week? You know, maybe 2 to 3 times. And the question is, for how long? So what I ask athletes is to, you know, focus on it when they do have these really intense training sessions. And then throughout the rest of the day, focus on complex carbohydrates that fit the rest of the day. You know, most people can't do high intensity training for the rest of the day. They're going to have easier sessions. So again, we need to adjust so that it fits appropriately the intensity that we are operating at. The other aspect to that, when we do look at high intensity training, is understanding the calorie needs that someone might have as a result of doing that session. And, you know, the better you become at long course triathlon, what you notice is that that demand increases. And so oftentimes we'll use high glycemic carbohydrates that don't have a whole lot of fiber to actually help restore energy from workouts that have been done. And a lot of it's because it's just that much easier to digest. It's going to oxidize very quickly, but underneath that scenario, that's okay. For the high fat athlete, oftentimes we focus on an increase in high glycemic carbohydrates just before and during the session, and then resume back to their standard intake. As soon as they stop, they might have a serving of low glycemic carbohydrates, but overall they'll go back to it. So it does differ a little bit. If they are a high fat athlete, they will use it before and during, but they go as close to back to ketosis as they possibly can, the keto-based nutrition, as soon as they stop. They may have a low glycemic carb just after that. So
I think those are all really great examples of kind of how to fuel for various intensities of workouts. I'm curious kind of what you would recommend or what you would say for how this changes when you have back-to-back sessions. I mean, triathletes are frequently doing their brick workouts. So as they're going from bike to run and, you know, extending the duration of that, how might that change with those back-to-back sessions?
Yeah, so typically what I advise athletes is to look at the total duration of the training sessions that they're getting ready to do, especially when you may not have time in between sessions to fuel yourself. So if they're actually doing a brick session, that's a great example. Or if they just have an hour in between maybe the bike and the run, what we do is rely on those easy to digest carbohydrates. And that really comes down to the individual themselves, the type that they will use and the type that they know they can take on board and not compromise themselves from an energy availability standpoint of view. So for many athletes, that's turning around and saying, hey, what feels good to you right after that, you know, moderate to hard bike? Oh, this is what feels good. You know, you'll put this into your system. Okay, let's go with that. And then turning around and making sure they fuel the run, you know, with something equivocal to that in terms of digestibility, ease for ingesting during training, because usually at that point you've gone and trained for more than an hour and they're into their second hour, maybe even third or fourth hour of training when it's a triathlete.
So we talked about kind of snacking a little bit earlier. Specifically, we talked about Andrew Harley snacking about an hour before he does an afternoon workout. But just beyond that one example, just kind of thinking about snacks in general, you know, people go for that afternoon snack. They're trying to get some calories, some energy in, you know, but between lunch and dinner or whatever time the snack is occurring, do we need to adjust what we're snacking on for these different types of training days? Should it be different if our sessions are zone two, zone four, really hard, really long, when we're just, you know, snacking in between meals?
Yeah, so snacking in between meals should oftentimes be low glycemic. And when I say low glycemic, I'm not just referring to carbohydrates. I'm referring to making sure you incorporate protein and fat into the snack as well, because typically most snacks do need to have a combination to keep the glycemic load low enough. The exception to that, however, is in those athletes with that really high calorie burn. Okay, and that's where I will say, look, you're an exception to the rule, or this is a particular day in your training that is an exception to the rule, in which maybe we do turn around and have some trick cereal. And people are like, well, why are you having trick cereal? And I said, well, it tastes good to them and it's easy to digest and they can consume, you know, a good bit of calories that way.
Yeah.
And sometimes athletes will message me and they'll say, are you sure this is okay? Are you sure having whatever
I can have a Pop-Tart?
Yeah, that's right. Are you sure I can have this? And I said, yes, on a day like today, please feel free to go ahead and have it. And what you realize is that those days are not overly frequent for most of us. Now at the more, you know, advanced levels, maybe like where Elizabeth is at or, you know, other pro triathletes, those days become more frequent, predominantly because they are burning 5,000 to 6,000 calories a day, and they've got to get the fuel in so they don't compromise their training or their recovery. So it's something where we have exceptions to the rules, but I will say for most of us, you know, everyday people, it's got to stay pretty low glycemic. So that's why you'll see a lot of the snacks that I put together for people have combinations. They don't just have a one-off macronutrient. They're filled with both, you know, protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And I like to focus in on that protein for athletes, especially endurance athletes, because oftentimes they forget about it.
Well, I just heard I can, you know, go buy a box of Trix cereal again. This is awesome. I have not had that. And
you've been given permission.
I don't know how many years. So might have to incorporate that in again. I'm liking this.
Elizabeth, what was your favorite childhood cereal? Was it Trix?
No, it actually wasn't. It probably sounds super plain, but do you remember Kix?
Yes, I do.
Yes, I loved Kix. Yeah. I don't know if that, you know, relates to the former soccer player in me, too. Maybe there's a little correlation there. But Kix was absolutely my favorite cereal as a kid.
I'll nominate the chocolate version of Kix, which was Cocoa Puffs. Essentially the same thing, just with a little bit of fake, very fake chocolate flavoring in there. But yeah, I mean, to what Dr. Austin said, like, just as your average athlete, you know, normally one training session a day, you know, every now and then you have that brick, or every now and then you add a strength session in there. But I don't usually have workouts that are long enough in duration where I'm burning enough calories to have a massive snack like that, unless I get into, you know, a 70.3 or a full Ironman race prep phase, you know, where the runs get up to 2-3 hours, the long bikes get up to, you know, 3-5 hours. That's when suddenly I need more from my snacks than just, you know, a little bit of energy in between meals. But it makes sense, Elizabeth, that you need a little bit more than I do.
So where do sports nutrition products factor into all of that?
So, you know, that's always a good question, because I will say if there is one thing that triathletes are hit up with over and over again, it is so many different options out there on the sport nutrition industry side of the coin. And one of the biggest questions I always get is, when do I use these and how much do I actually rely on them? And so what I want to make a good point of is that if you're using sport nutrition products, it's because you're putting yourself into a caloric deficit that is significant enough that you have to fuel not only during training, but also immediately after training to make sure you can come into energy balance. And for most triathletes, I will tell you, it is only during training that we have to rely on those products. You know, some of the long course athletes tend to get into sessions that are significant enough that food alone does not allow them to meet all of their needs. But for most of us, we will need it predominantly during prolonged training sessions that are greater than an hour. Okay. And really, I try to move that needle more and more so these days towards 90 minutes and making sure that the session is, you know, I'd say moderate to high intensity. Sometimes it's, you know, a long session for a long course athlete that's, you know, 5-6 hours. And of course, you'll use it there, even if it's at lower intensity. But really, we need to be judicious with our sport nutrition products and make sure we're only taking them in to supplement what we cannot meet through food. So typically, for most of the athletes I work with, if their session is longer than an hour, they will for sure get some sport nutrition products, whether low or high glycemic, during the session. And then if it is a session that is a significant calorie deficit, and I know they have issues getting all the calories in, we will supplement with carbohydrate, especially afterwards, and maybe even some, you know, protein powder. And really, we need to leave that sport nutrition product side to, you know, achieving everything that cannot be met through food. And I can't emphasize that enough. For most of us, we need to rely on the food and the micronutrients we get from it.
So Dr. Austin, based on that concept, just that line of thinking, is carbohydrate loading before a race or before a big workout session, is that a necessity for endurance sports to kind of be able to have the energy you need through loading up on carbohydrates before the session, or is that more of a myth?
So loading up on carbohydrates before a session oftentimes is dependent on what you've been doing prior to that. So in some instances, we will have athletes come in training and they'll be underneath a state of low carbohydrate availability. And so we will then load up prior to performing the training session. So that's a very acute loading. Conversely, you may have people that believe they've got a carbohydrate load just to go out and actually do their actual competitive event. And for the most part, this is actually a myth, unless they are on a high-fat diet and one of their strategies is to acutely, in the few days leading up to the race, increase their carbohydrate availability. For most people, though, who are eating a standard nutritional plan, they are going to get plenty of glycogen restoration just by consuming their standard nutrition. Okay, they're going to cut back on volume and intensity of training, and the muscle glycogen stores, as long as they are consuming adequate nutrition, will become replete anyway. And so they don't have to be so concerned about going out and carbohydrate loading. Okay, the taper in and of itself allows for glycogen restoration. For those high-fat athletes, if they want a carbohydrate load, I would just tell you, be careful about the type of carbohydrates and how much you do use, because it may actually bump you too much out of your adaptations from going on to the high-fat diet side, and then you end up compromising yourself in competition. I would say for many high-fat athletes to just go ahead and work on carbohydrate intake immediately before the race and during the race is usually sufficient. So even in that instance, I would say that consistency is a better answer leading up to the race than to do something that is out of your norm.
So we've covered a lot of different kind of facts and just talked through, okay, low intensity sessions, you know, medium intensity sessions, high intensity sessions, snacks, different times of day, double workout days. And so we've pretty well covered kind of how to approach carbs as an energy source and how to kind of periodize that. So I guess my final question to kind of wrap us up today, Dr. Austin, is just for an athlete, because in some instances, we can only get so specific when we're talking about this because everybody's different. There are athletes that need more calories. There are athletes that need fewer calories. There are athletes that are taking a high-fat approach. There are athletes that are not taking a high-fat approach. And so we've been able to address that a little bit. So for some athletes out there, if they're hearing all this, if they're listening to the facts you've given, the advice you've given, you know, a lot of folks will be able to kind of tinker with the approach they currently have to kind of take in the advice that you gave. But for somebody that just, this sounds complex, they're not quite sure how to approach this for them, what encouragement would you give them to maybe consult with, a local nutritionist or even to reach out to you and to work further with you on really nailing down how to periodize the carbohydrate intake?
I would just encourage them from the health standpoint of view, I guess, as you know, America continues to change and the world continues to change. I think just getting a good understanding of you as a human being and what you look like on paper and how you can optimize for yourself, that's the encouragement I would give them. Because carbohydrates are important for performance, but they also have impacts on health. And so I think reaching out to them and understanding that for yourself is the biggest thing first and foremost. And if you want to try something on your own, I would say, hey, just take a look at in-training carbohydrate use. Try to master that before even, you know, knocking on the door of myself or someone like myself and say, how do I go about this? Can I figure it out for myself? And I think that's a number one step that, you know, any athlete can try to start to take with regards to carbohydrate periodization. It'll help them learn to take carbohydrates in and out of their nutrition plan based on their training. And I think that's one of the biggest steps forward that we can get an athlete to take with regards to carbohydrate periodization.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
One of my favorite ways to cool down just our shows at the end, you know, I get asked a lot of questions. Elizabeth gets asked a lot of questions, and I love getting athlete questions on the podcast. And today's cool down is a great chance for us to do that. We get a lot of great questions for Dr. Austin. And today's question comes from Sam from Salt Lake City, Utah. After listening to episode 45 about women's health and Reds, Sam just had a couple really great follow-up questions for Dr. Austin, kind of along the lines of that topic. So let's hear what Sam has to say.
Hi, my name is Sam. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. And I just finished listening to episode 45, again, the impact of triathlon training on women's health with Dr. Krista Austin, talking about Reds. There was a lot of conversation about women prior to menopause, but how does it affect women that are in menopausal, in the menopausal state? And say maybe women who are taking synthetic hormones. For example, I had a complete hysterectomy when I was 28, and have been taking synthetic hormones ever since. I'm now 56, and my general practitioner wants me to start coming off of the synthetic hormones. A little bit nervous in doing this because I know that there's going to be another big change in my body, and I know that hormones play a huge effect. So I'm just curious how this could make changes, and if there's any suggestions. When I talk to my doctor about it, he says, well, maybe you should just stop doing triathlons then. So a lot of curiosity there. I've tried to find and do some research on synthetic hormones and going off of it. But I know there's a huge group of women out there that are absolute incredible athletes that are over the age of 50 that are in that menopausal state. So a lot of curiosities there, Dr. Austin. Thanks.
So when we're talking about women that are in a menopausal state, and I'll just say that this can vary in terms of when this occurs for a female, because they can end up in a menopausal state, shall we say, with regards to their hormones at a variety of different ages. What we need to do first and foremost is remember that Reds in and of itself is not solely assessed and determined based on hormone concentrations, okay? And that's what's really important, is that we remember it has to do with a wide variety of factors, including bone density, caloric intake, energy balance, carbohydrate availability, and even an athlete's psychological perspective on their body image and where they believe they should be with regards to body weight and composition and how they manage that. Now, that being said, when we go through menopause, or when we think about menopause, we automatically think, oh, they've lost their hormones, right? And what will happen when someone does go into menopause is that they're not going to make all of the hormones that they used to. And the one that comes to mind for most women is estrogen. And so typically what we associate estrogen with is actually bone density. Okay, now the concept of bone density is multifaceted. It's not just dependent on estrogen. It's also dependent on things like energy intake, our ability to strength train and utilize that to help us increase bone density can impact those factors. So when we think about Reds, we need to think about it in a very multifaceted manner. And if doctors are saying, hey, we've had you on some hormone replacement therapy, we want to try and take you off of it, they need to be equivocally multifaceted in their assessment as to whether or not that is going to be right for you. And I would say first and foremost, the Reds assessment needs to be done. Maybe they reach out to a physiologist or a sports nutritionist and ask for help with that particular area, because Reds is not just about your hormones. It's a multifaceted assessment. And I think that's what doctors need to remember first and foremost. It can occur at any age and under any state of actual hormonal status. So I think it's important, regardless of where a female is at, or even a male, I should say that it's on both sides of the coin there for men and women, that we say, where are they overall, and not just look at the hormones themselves.
So Dr. Austin, what would you say to Sam, just in regards to what she was talking about with the use of synthetic hormones and her doctor's recommendation that she kind of start to come off of those synthetic hormones?
So I think when we talk about synthetic hormones, we have to think about women at all levels. And synthetic hormones are even utilized in birth control. And when Sam asks this question, it's good because we need to think about it very broadly. And the first thing we need to think about, even before we put a female on synthetic hormones, is why are we going to do that? Okay, are they doing it because they're not having a menstrual cycle? And the question is, why are they not having a menstrual cycle? You know, in Sam's case, she talked about having a hysterectomy. And oftentimes, you know, when they remove the ovaries as well, they don't produce estrogen any longer. And so in that instance, they may turn around and say, hey, we're going to give you synthetic hormones because you're not producing estrogen any longer underneath that state. Whereas in other females, when we think about giving them synthetic hormones and they come to us and they say, hey, we don't have a menstrual cycle. If it's not a situation like what Sam has talked about, we need to dig a little bit deeper and say, why is that menstrual cycle not there? And actually try to figure out that before we provide the synthetic hormones. The other reason athletes may come up and ask for synthetic hormones is because maybe they're having a lot of menstrual symptoms prior to their cycle, or they're having to compete on their menstrual cycle and it's not working out so well for them. And the question that doctors should ask is, okay, why is this? And is there anything outside of just synthetic hormones that can be done to help alleviate what they're reporting? And we used to work on this years and years ago, at least I started it years ago, where we would manipulate their nutrition during certain phases of the menstrual cycle to help control menstrual symptoms. And even if they did not want to be on synthetic hormones when they competed and there was, you know, potential for the athlete to compete on their menstrual cycles, we tried to prepare for that. Maybe it was through the periodization of training, so they did not have their menstrual cycle come on all of a sudden when they went to go compete, or even just trying to utilize nutrition to minimize the impact of their cycle on their ability to go out and compete. A lot of times that was dependent on the symptoms that they experienced themselves and also the type of sport and the duration of the sports event that they would have to compete at. So there's a lot of factors to take into consideration when you're looking at synthetic hormones. And I think, you know, Sam's is one example where you will see it. And then if doctors are going to take women off of those synthetic hormones, again, if they're an athlete, you've got to think about a very multifaceted approach. Like, are they training? Is there any potential that I need to have them stop training and make sure that they don't just, you know, cause a whole, you know, endocrine response by continuing to train when I take those hormones away? Do we need to change anything nutritionally? How might taking those hormones away alter what they need nutritionally? Okay. And so there's a number of factors that need to be considered. And what I would encourage doctors to do is to incorporate a physiologist into the process, because there are many factors that an athlete has to consider and say, why are we taking away the synthetic hormones? What are the potential consequences? What are the potential benefits of doing so? And so I would just tell Sam, look, this is a multifaceted question. You need to take a multifaceted approach to understanding whether or not coming off that hormone replacement therapy or any type of synthetic hormone for a female is the right thing to do, much like you would do prior to going on to it.
Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank Dr. Krista Austin and TriDot coach Elizabeth James for talking about carbohydrate and endurance training. Shout out to UCAN for partnering with us on today's episode. Head to UCAN.com to see what superstarch powered products could be best for you. Have any triathlon questions or topics you want to hear us talk about? Do just like Sam did and head to TriDot.com/podcast and click on leave us a voicemail to get your voice on the show, asking one of our coaches or experts your question. We'll have a new show coming your way soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.